Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Brother Robert Johnson. This is episode 186. In the news this week, TMR took a week off, that is the Masonic Roundtable, for some family vacations, and we will be back next week. However, I believe I will be absent. I'm doing a presentation for Palatine Lodge in Palatine, Illinois. If you're interested in coming out to that, it is the Colonial Masonry presentation. The Pleiades Masonic Symposium in Westchester, Illinois has been canceled. I do apologize, but it was the call of the Brethren of that lodge. They just didn't raise enough funds to put it on this year, so they are going to be rescheduling it for next year. I imagine anybody who did buy tickets to that event will get refunds. I wanted to remind everybody about Kogashel and his Birmingham 44 Lodge auction. So if you have something to donate to that auction, or if you want to help out with it, go ahead and head over to the link in the show notes for Birmingham 44's auction page. I went ahead and I have put in the order for the second run of Whence Came You lapel pins. Last time, I had a few different items. Among them were 19 lapel pins. We had cufflinks, we had tie bars. Altogether, we had 60 individual items to sell, and they sold out in about a day. So back by popular demand, and to help us meet our goals of bringing a few more shows onto the WCY media ticket, which is listener-supported Masonic education, are these new pins. They are the same design, but they are by a different manufacturer. These are a 0.75-inch lapel pin, solid brass, and plated in 24-karat gold. Very little gold, but just the same, it is nice. The pin clasp on the back is a deluxe E-clasp and not the simple butterfly clasp either, so it's not going to fall off. I will have the pins in hand by the end of April or early part of May, and I'll begin shipping those out to you if you have bought one of those on the presale. Yes, there is a presale. So if you visit wcypodcast.com and you click on our limited edition shop, or if you're on Facebook and you click shop now on our page, you will see a few items for sale, one of which is this lapel pin presale. The pin is in development already. It's already being done. It's paid for. So the presale numbers are not contingent for you to be getting a pin. It's already going to happen. So if you presale, you will get one, even if we only sell one presale. But as it stands, we have had tons of the presale orders. It's really going well. Everyone who pre-orders, regardless of how many we sell, will get one. That's just the way it's going to work. You'll also notice a few other things in there for sale, like our old-fashioned button pin for $5 and Steve Harrison's book, Tales from the Craft. We matched Amazon's price for the book, and the difference that it comes from a brother to a brother. So for $18, you can get that book. There's an option to have it personalized from my library to yours, or to not have any personalization at all. Either way, it's a free option. The books come packaged in a way that you will enjoy, very worthy of an unboxing, I should say. I think you will all enjoy it. I want to say congratulations to Brother Guillermo Sanchez for winning our Robert P. Lewis Audible Book Contest. He answered all three questions about the interview correctly. The first was, where is the battle going to be in the third book? And the answer was the home turf of the enemies of the United States. Number two, I asked, what does Rob Lewis teach and where does he teach? He teaches at the VA in Los Angeles, and he teaches writing therapies to vets with PTSD. And I said, where was the headquarters for the revolution in book number one? And he said, Texas, with three exclamation points. If you had only put one exclamation point, I think you'd be wrong. So three exclamation points after the word Texas. But I also would have accepted the Scottish Rite Temple in Texas. So a lot of cool things happening. I just want to let you guys know it's all on the way. In addition to those lapel pins that I did mention earlier that we're having made, we will have a few other items, but I will announce those once we get them because I don't have a picture to show you what they look like yet. So I didn't want to just put it out there and you see what the picture looks like or the drawing mock-up looks like and you like that. But when the actual item gets here, maybe you don't like it. I didn't want to have any of that. So we're going to wait to display. We've got three other items that are going to come out along with the lapel pin, but you'll have to wait and see what those are. So we'll move right along into the paper of the week. This week is The First Inauguration, Patriotic and Masonic, by Captain Kenneth R. Force, USMS. Right Worshipful Brother Force is a past master of St. Cecil Lodge No. 568. the Lodge of the Arts, and Nassau Lodge number 1016, both of New York. He's a past district deputy grandmaster of the 4th Manhattan District. For many years, he has been the director of music at the United States Merchant Marine Academy, Kings Point, New York, and regularly conducts the Academy's regimental band in concerts and at patriotic events. The following is partly excerpted from the program notes he prepared for a booklet of Masonic and Comment, both related to the period of George Washington's first inaugural as President of the United States. Quote, "Sir, I have the honor to transmit to Your Excellency the information of your unanimous election to the office of President of the United States of America. Suffer me, sir, to indulge the hope that so auspicious a mark of public confidence will meet your approbation and be considered as a sure pledge of the affection and support you are to expect from a free and enlightened people." End quote. Letter to the President-elect Washington from John Langdon, temporary President of the U.S. Senate. The above congratulatory note was delivered to General George Washington at Mount Vernon on April 14, 1789. Thus, from this humble beginning began the American presidency, an office that one day would become the most powerful and responsible position in the entire world. 2 days later, on April 16th, General Washington left his beloved Virginia home accompanied by his personal secretary, Colonel David Humphreys, and by Mr. Charles Thompson, Secretary of Congress, and the individual chosen to deliver the congratulatory message. The general, dressed in his familiar buff and blue uniform, looked resplendent upon his horse. All along the route to New York City, the party was greeted by a tumultuous outpouring of public adulation and enthusiasm. Each tiny village and town displayed its finest decorations. Even the general was overwhelmed by the receptions that greeted him every place he passed through. The most noteworthy greeting was at Trenton, New Jersey, where a magnificent arch was erected at Trenton Bridge displaying the motto, "The Defender of the Mothers Will Also Protect the Daughters." As Washington passed under the arch, a choir of white-robed mothers and daughters sang Alexander Reinagle's chorus, "Welcome, Mighty Chief, Once More." This work is dedicated to the President's wife, Martha. For weeks, elaborate preparations had been underway in New York for the arrival of the nation's war hero and leading example of the country's unity and pride. By the time of the inauguration, Washington had become a unifying symbol to the people, and his popularity took on a cult-like dimension. He was revered with an almost religious fervor, clearly reflected in the lyrics contained in the music of that period. On April 23rd, he arrived at Elizabethport, New Jersey. He was met by a committee from Congress and several other notable dignitaries, including a chancellor, Robert Livingston. Livingston would administer the oath of office a few days later. At the shore lay waiting a magnificent 45-foot-long barge commanded by Commodore James Nicholson, which had been constructed at great expense for the occasion. On its deck was a red-curtained enclosure beautifully decorated with festoons and symbols of the new republic. Rowing the barge were 13 river pilots dressed in white, who had been especially selected to transport the stately General Washington to Manhattan. Other barges accompanied the presidential vessel, filled with leading politicians and future cabinet members. As the presidential barge proceeded down the Hudson River, a chorus rose up from a sloop anchored in the harbor singing by Ode to the General. This ode is described in eloquent terms by the New York Packet. The voices of the ladies were as much superior to the flutes that played with the stroke of the oars in Cleopatra's silken corded barge as the very superior and glorious water scenes of New York Bay exceeds Cydnus in all its pride. We could with rapture dwell upon its interesting subject and wonder into the fields of fancy for expressions to paint the various and delightful appearances that vied with each other at the same time to welcome the great and illustrious man to our now happy city. Another description of the singing has been preserved in the writings of Congressman Elias Boudinot of New Jersey, who was part of the presidential party that day. Quote, "Before we got to the Bedler's Island, now Liberty Island, site of the Statue of Liberty, a large sloop came with full sail on the starboard bow, when about 20 gents and ladies rose up with excellent and melodious voices, sung an eloquent ode appropriate to the occasion, and set to the music of God Save the King, welcoming their great chief to the seat of government. At the conclusion, we gave them our hats, and then they, with the surrounding boats, gave three hurrahs, which made the neighborhood shores rebound with joyful acclamation." End quote. When the presidential barge passed the Spanish sloop of war, Galveston, the men of the ship fired a 13-gun salute and immediately displayed the flags of all foreign nations. Another 13-gun salute was fired as the barge rounded the battery, and finally, at Murray's Wharf, at the foot of Wall Street, a final salute of 13 guns was fired as the presidential barge landed. George Washington climbed the carpeted stairs to the pier, where he was greeted by the governor and mayor along with city and state officials. From the wharf, a grand procession was formed which accompanied the general to his new residence, the house of Samuel Osgood at Cherry Street in Franklin Square. As the procession progressed through the streets of the city, a tumultuous outpouring of public adulation greeted him, and the general was visibly and emotionally moved. Homes and businesses' establishments were decorated with signs, flags, and every festive decoration imaginable. At night, candles were displayed in windows as the city continued to celebrate. The United States Gazette reported, "Many persons who were in the crowd on Thursday were heard to say that they should now die contented, nothing being wanted to complete their happiness, previous to this auspicious period, but the sight of the savior of his country." Inauguration Day, April 30th, 1789, is unique in American history. Not only did it mark the taking of oath of office by America's first president, it was the only inauguration of an American president in New York City, the capital moving to Philadelphia for Washington's second inauguration, and those of his successor, John Adams. Thomas Jefferson was the first president to be inaugurated in the new capital city of Washington on the Potomac. The day began with a cannon salute fired from the battery at sunrise, an early wake-up call. At 9 o'clock, all the churches in the city held special religious services. At noon, Congress assembled at Federal Hall on Wall Street, and a procession of dignitaries, politicians, and militia proceeded to the presidential mansion on Cherry Street, the present site of the Brooklyn Bridge Tower, to accompany the president back to Federal Hall where Congress was meeting. The building had served as City Hall, but was remodeled by the architect LaFont. It stood on Wall Street at the head of Broad. With the president-elect that morning, as he wended his way to the hall were John Langford of New Hampshire, Charles Carroll of Maryland, and William Samuel Johnson of Connecticut. They were escorted by selected military units commanded by General William Malcolm, with Morgan Lewis, later Grand Master of New York, serving as Marshal, and Jacob Morton and Leonard Bleeker as aides. So great was the press of spectators in Broad Street that Washington and his immediate party were obliged to dismount and walk the last 100 yards. Behind them, the crowds broke through the ranks of the military. The windows were jammed wherever they provided any view of the spectacle, and even the housetops along Broad Street were taken advantage of for a bird's-eye view of the stirring scene taking place below. At Federal Hall, Washington entered the Senate chamber where he was received by the Vice President John Adams and the assembled congressmen and senators. Adams spoke as follows, quote, "Sir, the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States are ready to attend you to take the oath required by the Constitution, which will be administered by the Chancellor of the State of New York," end quote. The reply was a dignified, quote unquote, "I am ready to proceed." The oath was administered in the outer gallery, so that it would be done in the most public manner, and according to Washington Irving, who at the age of 7 was an eyewitness, there was a table in the center upon which lay a superbly bound Bible, on a crimson velvet cushion. In other accounts, the Bible was missing, and Jacob Morton, who was then both Grand Secretary of the Grand Lodge of New York and Master of St. John's Lodge No. 1, later Grand Master of New York, went to the lodge room nearby to borrow the altar Bible. Either way, there is no doubt that the Bible published in 1767 was the property of St. John's Lodge, constituted in 1757, and it remains a treasured possession to this day. Elected officers of the Grand Lodge today take their obligation on this Bible, and it has been present at several presidential inaugurations. It will be on display at the White House from January through March 1989, and it will be part of the bicentennial celebration of the first inauguration on April 30th, 1989. Washington made his appearance clad in a dark brown suit of American manufacture woven in Samuel Hinsdale's mill in Hartford. With a steel-hilted sword, he advanced to the front of the balcony, laid his hand upon his breast, bowed solemnly several times, and then returned to an armchair near the table. After the cheering subsided, he arose and again stepped forward. Vice President John Adams stood on his right. At his left was Chancellor Robert R. Livingston, Grand Master of Masons in New York, who administered the oath. Nearby were the generals Richard Henry Lee, Henry Knox, Arthur St. Clair, Baron von Steuben, House Speaker Frederick A. C. Muhlenberg, and New York Governor George Clinton, ironically leader of the Anti-Federalist at the New York Ratification Convention in Poughkeepsie 2 years earlier. After the constitutional oath was given, concluded with the words, "So help me God," Samuel Aline Otis, Secretary of the Senate, who held the Bible, would have raised it to Washington's lips, but the President bent down reverently and kissed the holy book, opened to Genesis chapter 49. Stepping to the railing, Chancellor Livingston announced to the crowd below, "It is done. Long live George Washington, President of the United States." At that moment, the flag was raised on the cupola of Federal Hall, which signaled the artillery at the battery to render a salute. The bells of the city rang forth and the populace screamed forth shouts of joy. After the balcony ceremony, President Washington entered the Senate chamber and delivered his inauguration address to the assembled Congress. Then, in another procession, he left Federal Hall and proceeded with the Vice President to nearby St. Paul's Chapel of Trinity Church for religious services, a practice followed to this day by New York Masons who have reenacted the oath-taking ceremony for many years. That evening, the city was beautifully illuminated, as parties and balls were held in celebration of the momentous event, the first inauguration, one in which the principal, a Freemason, took an oath administered by a Grand Master of Masons upon the Bible of a Masonic lodge and witnessed by other Masonic and public dignitaries. We are all proud of Washington as our first president. We can be equally proud of him as a Freemason. All right, now is the time on the show where I ask you to support the show. But before I talk about the apps, I did need to tell you about some application updates. So soon, the people who make our applications are going to change the name of the way you get it on Apple devices. Currently, you have Podcast Box. Podcast Box is going to be replaced by Podcast Source. It is the same. If you have access to the show now, all you have to do is click Restore Purchases when you download it, and it will bring the show back for you. However, if you don't have the app yet and you're going to buy it in the future, it will be a standalone application. You won't have to go through Podcast Box or Podcast Source. It will just be there. I know it sounds confusing, but once it's all done, we will provide links and some great instruction there for you to be able to check those out. But in any case, there is a Whence Came You application for Android, Apple, and Windows Phone. What the application does is allows you to listen to the show streaming, or you can download it and listen to it later. You can listen to it on airplane mode, all these great things. But the real benefit is that you have access to the papers that we read on the show, as well as wallpapers that we put together every week for your mobile phone, your mobile device. They're always Masonically themed. And on occasion, we'll upload videos or books. It's a really cool thing. You can take the papers right to Lodge with you and pop them open. If you're an education officer and maybe you're running short on something, you need something to talk about for a Lodge meeting, open your phone, flip to a paper that you enjoyed, and download it and read it right there in Open Lodge. It's kind of a lifesaver. In addition, we do have some ways you can do some shopping that the proprietors of these organizations send us a little bit back to the show. And it's a win-win because they have given me a coupon code to give to you to use. So if you visit onnit.com, which is known worldwide for their healthy living supplements and things like Alpha Brain, you can use the coupon code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off and they send a little bit back to us. If you are on freemasonryart.com, checking out the amazing artwork there by Brother Juan Sepulveda, you can use the coupon code WCY and get the same 10% off, and he throws a little bit back to the show. And our newest sponsor is FreemasonTees.com. FreemasonTees.com is a really great website. They have some neat t-shirt designs that you're not going to see anywhere else. My favorite design they have right now, of course, is the Illinois Mason shirt. You'll have to see it to check it out. I've posted it on our Facebook page a few times. I have that shirt. It's one of my favorite shirts to wear to Masonic meetings. Again, use coupon code WCY. You'll get 10% off, and he will support the show with a little donation back to us. And of course, we are running our lapel pin pre-sale. Now, the lapel pin pre-sale, again, if you order the pin now, you will get it as soon as I get them in. I am expected to receive them at the end of April, early part of May. As soon as they get them, I'm going to be packaging things up like a madman and shipping everything out as soon as possible. The pins are $10, and we had to do shipping this time on top of that, so it's $10 plus $2 for shipping, and that again is going to help fund us with our listener-supported Masonic education endeavors. And last but not least is PayPal. You choose the amount, whether it's a dollar or two, it goes right into the show and helps keep the show alive by keeping all of the past episodes available for everybody forever. So thanks in advance for not just supporting the show, but essentially being a producer of the show. All right, being the off week for Brother Matt Wonacki, who normally does our esoteric Freemason segment, he's off this week, as I just said, so I will read a little bit for you from one of my favorite Masonic authors and occult authors, is Manly P. Hall. I wanted to read an excerpt from his short pamphlet type book called Occult Anatomy of Man. So I wanted to read again, like I mentioned, a little bit of Manly P. Hall's Occult Anatomy of Man. This is a very interesting book. If you want to go ahead and get it, you can download it at Digitized by Knowledge Files. KnowledgeFiles.com is who hosted it. I always download their things and I just print them out. So I'm reading from a paper copy, but if I can, I will include this in the PDF bonus features, or at least the excerpt. Now, the Occult Anatomy of Man is broken into several parts, and the first part is called The Human Body in Symbolism. And I think that's what I'm going to focus on in this short excerpt. I'm not even going to read the entire part because I think I don't want to spoil anything for anybody out there. And I think if it's something you're interested in, you can dive in as deep as you want to go. The Occult Anatomy of Man, Part 1, The Human Body and Symbolism. In Scripture, we are told that God made man in his own image. It is so stated not only in the Christian Bible, but also in the holy writings of nearly all enlightened people. The Jewish patriarchs taught that the human body was the microcosm, or the little cosmos, made in the image of the macrocosm, or the great cosmos. This analogy between the finite and infinite is said to be one of the keys by the aid of which the secrets of the Holy Writ are unlocked. There is no doubt that the Old Testament is a psychological and anatomical textbook to those capable of reading it from a scientific viewpoint. The function of the human body, the attributes of the human mind, and the qualities of the human soul have been personified by the wise men of the ancient world, and a great drama has been built around the relationships to themselves and to each other. To the great Egyptian demigod Hermes, the human race owes its concept of law and analogy. The great Hermetic axiom was, that which is above is like unto that which is below, and that which is below is like that unto which is above. The religions of the ancient world were all based upon nature worship, which in a degenerated form has survived to our own clay as phallicism. The worship of the parts and functions of the human body began in the latter Lemurian period, during the Atlantean epoch. This religion gave to sun worship, but the new faith incorporated into it doctrines, many of the rituals and symbols of the previous belief. The building of temples in the form of the human body is a custom common to all peoples. The tabernacle of the Jews, the great Egyptian temple at Karnak, the religious structures of the Hawaiian priests, and the Christian churches laid out in the form of a cross are examples of this practice. If the human body were laid out with arms spread in the shape of any of these buildings, it would be found that the high altar would occupy the same relative position in the building that the brain occupies in the human body. All the priests of the ancient world were anatomists. They recognized that all the functions of nature were reproduced in miniature in the human body. They therefore used man as the textbook, teaching their disciples that to understand man was to understand the universe. These wise men believed that every star in the heavens, every element in the earth, and every function in nature was represented by a corresponding center pole or activity within the human body. This correlation between nature without and the nature of man within, which was concealed from the multitudes formed in the secret teachings of the ancient priestcraft. Religion in Atlantis and Egypt was taken much more seriously than it is today. It was the very life of these peoples. They had complete control over the millions of ignorant men and women who had been taught since childhood that these robed and bearded patriarchs were direct messengers from God, and it was believed that any disobedience to the commands of the priests would bring down upon the offender's head the wrath of the Almighty. The temple depended for its maintenance upon the secret wisdom, which gave its priests control over certain powers of nature and made them vastly superior in wisdom and understanding to the lady whom they controlled. These wise ones realized that there was a great deal more involved in religion than the chanting of mantras and the singing of hymns. They realized that the path of salvation could be walked successfully only by those who had practical scientific knowledge of the occult function of their own bodies. The anatomical symbolism which they evolved in order to perpetuate this understanding has come down to modern Christianity, but the keys to it apparently have been lost. It is a tragic situation for religionists that they are surrounded by hundreds of symbols which they cannot understand, but it is still sadder that they have even forgotten that these symbols even had any meaning other than the foolish interpretations which they themselves have concocted. The idea prevalent in the minds of Christians that their faith is the one and only true inspired doctrine, and that it came parentless into the world, is unreasonable in the extreme. A study of comparative religions proves beyond doubt that Christianity has begged, borrowed, and stolen its philosophies and concepts from the religions and philosophies of the ancient and medieval pagan worlds. Among the religious symbols and allegories which belonged to the world long ago before the coming of Christianity are a few to which we would like to call your attention. The following Christian symbols and concepts are of pagan origin. And I think that's where I'm going to leave you with that. It is quite interesting to read what Manly P. Hall has to say about some of the origins of Christian symbology. A kind of exciting read at points. I will be honest that this book is dry in some areas, but nonetheless, I would encourage you guys to check that book out. And if you guys are interested, let me know. The book is short enough, I would be able to prepare some sort of audio version of the entire book. If you guys would like it, shoot me an email over at wcypodcast.com and let me know if you want me to put this together and I can put it in a form of, say, like an audiobook. Now, this week's famous Freemason is E.B. Eddy, born February 10th, 1906, and he passed away August 22nd, 1827. Born in Vermont, industrialist Ezra Butler Eddy, the matchmaker of the world, moved his small friction match factory from Burlington, Vermont to Hull, Quebec in 1851. He expanded, modernized, and diversified to produce a variety of wood and paper products. Eddy was a member of Quebec legislature from 1871 to 1875. He was alderman of Hull from January 21st, 1878 to January 17th, 1888, and mayor of this city from January 24th, 1881 to January 28th, 1885, and from January 25th, 1887 to January 17th, 1888. He also served as president of the Ottawa Ladies' College. Eddy Lodge No. 41, Hull, was granted a dispensation dated 8 May 1873 and received warrant No. 298 on the 10th of July 1873 from the Grand Lodge of Canada. The first worshipful master was E.B. Eddy. Eddy Lodge affiliated with the Grand Lodge of Quebec on the 23rd of September 1874. The endorsation thereof on its warrant was made on 10th December 1874 when it became No. 41, QR. That's it for this week. Please find us on Facebook. Check out the Shop Now button there if you'd like. Find us on Twitter at WhenceCameU. Check us out on Google Plus if you want that also. And you can find us at the email address wcypodcast at gmail.com. If you'd like to email me there, that's fine. Or you can email me at admin at wcypodcast.com. If you are so inclined, please check out the Midnight Freemasons 3 times a week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays for all new content. 3 articles every week. If you want to share them with your brothers, that's fine. If you want to share them with the profane, that's fine. If you want to read them in Lodge, that's fine. If you want to put them on your own blog, it's totally fine. We just ask that you please give proper attribution. You post the article in its entirety, and to whoever wrote it, make sure that it is properly credited. Please don't forget to check out the Masonic Roundtable every Tuesday night at 10, 9 Central, except last Tuesday, which was a rarity. I think that's the first time we've ever missed an episode. We even did episodes for Christmas and New Year's this last year, so it was a first for everything, I guess. Again, 10, 9 Central every Tuesday, live on Google Hangouts. And then after it's over, you can catch it on our YouTube channel, in perpetuity. All the episodes are there for you to enjoy. And if you don't like watching us, please check us out on the audio version of the podcast version. So you can just find that right in iTunes. It's the Masonic Roundtable. And perhaps I will see you at Palatine Lodge in just a few days. In any case, I hope you guys all have an awesome week. Stay on the level. Thanks for buying those pins. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.